From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., a city from which members of Congress are fleeing in a sprint, motivated by the quickly advancing national midterm elections.
The terrorists haven't won, and we should tell them in plain English, no, there will never be a mosque at Ground Zero. I'm Renee Elmer.
I'm Carl Paladino. As governor, I will use the power of eminent domain to stop the mosque and use the site as a war memorial instead of a monument to those who attacked our country.
I'm Congressman Alan Grayson, and I approve this message.
Religious fanatics try to take away our freedom in Afghanistan, in Iran, and right here in Central Florida.
Submit to me.
Taliban Dan Webster.
My goodness sakes, you figured out already this is not a program on hospitality today. Or if it is, we've got the wrong guests. As the midterm election shifts into high gear, some candidates, as you've just heard, are going into overdrive with rhetoric that demonizes a particular minority, Muslim Americans. We take a look today at the politics of religious intolerance. Our very special guest is Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota.
I have an image in my head of like hitting a dial on some of these game shows, and it might land on a different color. Well, you could put Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, anywhere on that wheel, and every time history spins the wheel and it lands on somebody, you never know who it's going to land on. It could be the group you're in.
The two-term Democrat was the first Muslim elected to Congress, and he'll help us get a perspective on the history and the impact of this growing wave of fear-mongering. But I have to tell you, it's not all gloom and doom. This week, President Obama spoke poignantly about his faith and the role of religion as he sees it in American political discourse.
I think my public service is part of that effort to express my Christian faith. But as President of the United States, I'm also somebody who deeply believes that part of the bedrock strength of this country is that it embraces people of many faiths and of no faith.
I think it's a textbook example of the possibility of civil discourse, even in these times of overheated rhetoric. We're going to take a close listen to his words and analyze the lessons they contain. Also on this week's State of Belief Radio, we'll take a look at the new survey from the Pew Forum on religion and public life that suggests that a surprisingly large number of Americans don't really know much about their own faith traditions, to say nothing of their familiarity with other faiths. You're going to be surprised by this survey. But first, it's always a pleasure to welcome back to State of Belief Radio my friend Greg LaBelle. Greg is Assistant Professor of Political Management and Director of the Semester in Washington program at the George Washington University. He's also a veteran of several presidential campaigns, and he joins us now in studio. Greg, we've certainly got a lot to talk about, and I'm glad you're here so we can do it.
It's good to be here as we come down to the wire.
Think we can find anything to talk about today?
I think we'll come up with something.
You know what? I am I'm intrigued by what I hear, but I'm also intrigued by what I don't hear in this campaign season. Silence has to do with conservative Christian rhetoric in the election. We're not talking much about religion except for Glenn Beck.
Right.
That's kind of an anomaly anyway.
Right.
Why is it so silent?
Well, in a nutshell, I think it's because the Tea Party movement has sucked all the air out of the room. That's the story. That's where people are focused. And the result is we're not hearing a lot of other stuff. In fact, I think we're seeing some pieces of the religious right trying to fight back at that. If you look at the Pledge to America, just before that thing was released, Tony Perkins was out there on the stumps basically saying, we better be in there. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, there's one sentence in the preamble of this thing that talks about marriage and abortion, and there's nothing else there. So I don't think that the folks who usually will respond to this kind of thing feel the need right now.
So drinking the tea makes you not care much about religion.
I think yes, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, I think that's true. It's just not on anybody's radar screen.
of course, now, having said that, the one religion that is at the center of the campaign is Islam.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
people are trying to outdo each other with this anti-Muslim
yeah.
fever.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of factors here. One of them, I think, is what I call the politics of the other. And I think we saw this a little bit in 2008 with then candidate Obama. And I think this continues. I think to some extent since the end of the Cold War, there have been political factions in this country that have been looking for a new other. And, you know, everyone's been on the chopping block. If you're African American or Hispanic or Asian, you know what that's about. I think that gays and lesbians played that role for a while. And I think that didn't hold for a very long time. I think people began to realize that, you know, we really don't have a secret agenda. But then all of a sudden, Islam landed, and it's just been the gift that keeps on giving to some of these folks.
I want you to listen to something. The listeners have already heard it once, and I want you to hear it because I want to ask you some questions about it. Listen to these clips from political ads.
The terrorists haven't won, and we should tell them in plain English, no, there will never be a mosque at Ground Zero. I'm Renee Elmers.
I'm Carl Paladino. As governor, I will use the power of eminent domain to stop the mosque and use the site as a war memorial instead of a monument to those who attacked our country.
Now, Greg, is there any place in American politics for that stuff?
I'm loaded for bear on this one. No, this is the kind of rhetoric that we should all be absolutely appalled at. I think that Joe McCarthy is standing up and cheering, and I don't say that lightly. This is the kind of rhetoric that I think does great damage to the democratic process. People who say things like this, I think, fall into one of two categories. They either know that they're not telling the truth and are willing to do it for short-term gain, and that in these cases is election, or they don't know that they're not telling the truth, and it's a kind of ignorance. But it's not the regular brand of ignorance. I think it's a willful ignorance. It's very difficult, I think, for a reasonable person to actually believe some of the stuff that these people are saying.
Mm-hmm. Last weekend, I was in Louisiana, and I talked with a woman who is somewhat elderly and tried to reason with her about some of these ads. They have scared her absolutely to death.
Mm.
So she's not able to be reasonable about it. Mm. They're going to take over our country. I mean, what can we do? I mean, some of us will leave on the TV or the radio and listen to the ads and then criticize them. But do they realize what they're doing to people?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. This is based in fear. This is the politics of the other once again, but it is fear based. It draws from that sort of McCarthyistic approach of fear, veiled accusations, secret lists, all that kind of stuff that we'd like to think is not part of the American debate anymore. But it clearly has become that in this cycle. And what do Americans do? I think we have to respond at the voting booth. The prospect of people like this being elected to public office is really quite a frightening thing, because this debate, this will not stop. This rhetoric doesn't stop on November 2nd. This rhetoric will continue when these people are playing roles in the Congress, in governor's seats, and so on and so forth.
I don't want to make a sweeping generalization, and I know you won't let me, but the Democrats haven't been all that bold.
Oh, God. No, not at all. You know, I think one of the things with Renee Elmer's piece is Bob Etheridge's lack of response in this. And I think if Democrats would stand up and say, this is what I believe and this is why I believe it, they might be surprised at the positive reaction that they get from that. But this refusal to take a stand only feeds this kind of rhetoric.
Greg, There is another role for religion in campaigns, and that has to do with values.
Hmm.
why aren't we talking about the stuff that's wrong with America and just focusing on someone we want to put all the blame on?
It's an interesting phenomenon. I was thinking about that earlier. You know, back in the mid-'80s, I think we got into a place in particular in national politics where character became an issue. And I think we watched questions start to be asked around marital fidelity, drug use and in college, and all those kinds of questions. And, you know, there can be a debate over whether they're legitimate. I think what's going on is as America's problems and their solutions have gotten bigger and more complex, I think we have naturally sort of begun to look more closely at what's the character of the candidate like. How can I trust this person to do the right thing? I mean, to oversimplify it a little bit. And somehow that question seems to have been replaced by, what's this guy's religious faith? It's not a legitimate question. Mm-hmm. It seems to me it's not a legitimate question, but it seems to have replaced that broader question about character. Yeah. I suppose we have to look back again to the 80s and 90s, where when the Christian Coalition was in its heyday, and we moved, I think, in our national debate from that the idea that if you disagree with me, you're wrong, to if you disagree with me, you're evil.
Is anybody going to cast a vote on the basis of a candidate's stand on the prospect of building an Islamic studies center in Manhattan?
Boy, I'd like to say no, but I don't think I can.
You think that really will be a litmus test for some people?
I do think for some people that will be the question.
My guest has been Greg LaBelle, Assistant Professor of Political Management and Director of the Semester in Washington Program at the George Washington University. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Still ahead on this week's show, a closer look at President Obama's words on faith and the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life survey showing a surprising lack of knowledge about organized religions on the part of religious Americans. And up next, the unique perspective of the first Muslim elected to the United States Congress. What's Representative Keith Ellison's perspective on the demonization of Islam's followers in this election year? How's the issue resonating on Capitol Hill? We'll get the answers. State of Belief continues in just a moment. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Islamophobia is on the rise in America. There's no question about that. What makes that fact especially depressing is watching politicians using disparaging rhetoric about Muslim Americans as a way to advance their own political careers. I've been wanting to talk about this situation with Congressman Keith Ellison, a Democrat who represents Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. Congressman Ellison is completing his second term on Capitol Hill. He was the first Muslim elected to Congress, and conservatives didn't lose any time, I'm sure you remember, creating an uproar when at his 2007 swearing-in ceremony, they saw the congressman place one hand on the Quran before taking his oath of office. Attempts to create a controversy were not muted by the fact that the particular Quran used in the ceremony had once belonged to Thomas Jefferson. Since that time, Congressman Ellison has been an outspoken critic of the fear-mongering tactics that have spread like wildfire across our political landscape. Congressman Ellison, welcome back to State of Belief.
Well, it's always great to be on State of Belief, Reverend Gaddy. Thank you for having me.
Are you surprised, or are you disappointed about this rapid rise in anti-Muslim bias?
Well, quite frankly, Reverend Gaddy, I'm taking it in stride. I mean, the fact is that there are certain individuals who are trying to whip up this scapegoating sort of phenomena. But I'm also heartened by the interfaith coalition that is emerging to say that, you know, all faiths, all colors, all cultures are welcome here in America. I mean, yeah, we can focus on, you know, the Terry Joneses of this world, or we can focus on people like Michael Bloomberg, who said as the mayor of New York that we are not going to have any second and first class citizenship when it comes to houses of worship and who can build one where. All religions are welcome. All religions have the right to pursue their faith. And, you know, I could also, even I'm proud of our president, President Obama, who waded into this controversy. And so, you know, there's a lot of good things that have happened, too. And sometimes crisis brings the best out of us. And I think for a lot of people, that's true.
Do you have the feeling that someone's feeding this trend? And maybe you know who it is.
Yes, I do. I would say that a woman by the name of Pam Geller, runs her own website called Atlas Shrugged. And then there's a man named Robert Spencer, who runs a website called Stop the Islamization of America. And then there's another website called Jihad Watch. Their fingerprints are all over a lot of different controversies that have brewed up. And they and these people are not sensitive to the election cycle. They're busy, election or not. But what they hope happens is that around, if they can get an election, they can get some pandering politicians, and if they can get a hot-button issue like Park 51, they hope that, you know, the constellation of forces will ignite and that they can really, really get some wind behind their sail.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the fact is that they don't really understand America very well, because people like Jerry Nadler, the congressman in whose district Ground Zero sits, you know, will stand up for the Constitution. And so will people like Hannah Rosenthal, who is a special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism, who works with the U.S. State Department. Various people from various and diverse religious backgrounds understanding that, you know, that we're not, that when ugly is allowed to gain momentum, sometimes it becomes unstoppable. And we've seen situations like that in history,
mm-hmm.
that have had catastrophic results for humanity. There certainly is an anti-Islamic industry. And by the way, it's worldwide. Europe has some specific individuals who keep this stuff going.
Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota is the nation's first Muslim elected to Congress. We'll be right back. We'll be talking with Congressman Ellison, and you don't want to miss it. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Everybody, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We're talking with Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota, who became the first Muslim member of the House of Representatives when initially elected to Congress in 2006. Congressman Ellison, I know that there have been those sad times in our history. We weren't hospitable to the Jews. We weren't hospitable to Roman Catholics as they began to populate our nation. So there is some precedent for that. Is there precedent for politicians in elections trying to pander to that kind of hatred for their own good?
Sadly, it's one of the oldest traditions in our nation.
I would
recommend people study Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who was a Reconstruction politician who started out arguing that that America needed to focus on the welfare of the working man and woman. He then morphed into an arch segregationist, his argument being, yes, he's for the working men and women, but only if they're white, and became one of the most well-known populists. He was a populist, but also most racist people who ushered in segregation in the 19th century. We've had examples of where people have demonstrated tremendous courage as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charles Sumner, who was only a few years before Pitchfork Bill Ben Tillman. standing up for, he was a politician, he was an office holder. He was the one who coined the phrase 40 acres and a mule because he recognized that the new freedmen couldn't really make a go of it if they didn't have any land or any education or any economic wherewithal. You know, it's not always the people who are in the targeted group who stand up and raise the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in this one, there are Christians, there are Jews, there are Buddhists and Baha'i who stand up and say, no, you cannot exclude our fellow Muslim Americans. There were whites who stood up against slavery and abolition and for the rights of the freedmen.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing is to call on everybody. Just say, look, you know, you never know who the hate dial is going to land on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have an image in my head of, like, spin a dial on some of these game shows, and it might land on a different color.
Yes.
Well, you could put Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, anywhere on that wheel, and every time the history spins the wheel and it lands on somebody, you never know who it's going to land on. It could be the group you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense for everybody to stand and say, we're going to deal with people's behavior, not their religion. You recall that George Wallace was actually out segregationed before he said that great historic phrase, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation
mm-hmm.
forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact is he felt he lost an election because he wasn't strident enough on the issue of segregation.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided that would never happen to him again. And we all know how that story ended.
Mm-hmm.
Segregation, Jim Crow was defeated. Blacks and whites and all Americans enjoyed social equality before the law. And so I'd say that history's not on the side of the Pandaverse, but they're there.
Congressman, I have watched you and your very unique position being the first Muslim elected to Congress. Now we have Representative Andre Carson of Indiana as the second. I have been in meetings with you at home and abroad. I remember in Doha, Qatar, how much respect you received from people all over the Middle East. Have you noticed any increased bias toward you personally, either in Congress or in your home district in Minnesota during this time?
Yeah, I have detected some bias, but it's nothing that we can't handle if we keep on asserting the best and most noble principles of our nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that we have a broad group speaking against it, but I have seriously seen that bias. I'll tell you one other thing that bothers me about this whole phenomenon, and that is that there, in fact, are transnational terrorists who are Muslim. And these people got together and killed 3,000 of our fellow Americans, about 200 of whom were killed at 9/11 were Muslim, by the way. And I just don't want these people like the Anwar al-Awlakis and the Osama bin Ladens and the Ayman Sawaris to ever believe that they have an advantage because they can seize upon the political rhetoric in America to help argue to unsuspecting Muslims that America's at war with Islam.
Yeah.
These guys need to be discouraged and demoralized. We don't have to pander to them either. All we have to do is stand on our constitutional footwork and say, you know, America's open for all people. But I will say that I think the president was right when he said, look, burning a bunch of Qurans and putting it on YouTube is a recruitment bonanza
right.
for these people who would want to harm us. And because that is their essential argument, America's at war with Islam. But America's not at war with Islam. America's not at war with Christianity. America's not at war with Judaism. America's not at war with any faith tradition. America is for freedom of religion.
Tell us briefly what it has been like for you to be in the United States Congress as a devoted Muslim.
Enriching. It's given me experiences that I wish I could share with nearly everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we face some adversity, and I don't mean to diminish it, but I can also tell you that I believe I've been incredibly privileged to serve with the good men and women on both sides of the aisle in the Congress. It is true that people have said nasty and unkind things about me and my religion, but none of those things compare to the decency that I have experienced with people like Nancy Pelosi, who didn't know me at all, but when the whole thing got raging about me swearing in on the Quran, she grabbed my hand and she pulled me to her and said to me, you can swear in on anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, President Bush, when I visited him in my first few months of being in Congress, said he thinks it's a good thing that there's a Muslim in the Congress, and then repeated it a few more times.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was so funny that I said, I think it's a good thing that there's a Methodist in the presidency, and he got a big laugh out of that. But my point is that it's been a great experience. During the Bush administration, whenever the State Department asked me to help work on public diplomacy, I was proud to do it. I do the same during the Obama administration. I see my role as making friends for America. I didn't run as a Muslim or as a representative of my faith. I'm not a religious leader. But if I can help bridge gaps between Americans and between America and the rest of the world, I am going to be found doing that.
Congressman Ellison, I can't thank you enough for your time and for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Rev.
In the search for respectful language when discussing faith and religion, the President of the United States set what I think is a terrific example this past week. We're going to take a closer look at what I mean and examine the surprising results of a Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life survey of Americans' knowledge of the major religions that play such an important role in our society. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Religion and politics are a volatile mix by any measure, anywhere, anytime. In recent years, that volatility has intensified significantly by candidates for public office using religious confessions to try to win elections. Now, that new wrinkle in campaign stump speeches has made voters more sensitive to the issue, and thus, it has increased voters' questions about candidates' faith. Since its inception, Interfaith Alliance has monitored political speech and challenged those who made religion an issue in an election. Candidates claiming that people should support them simply because they're more religious than their opponents. And at the same time, we've encouraged people to ask candidates how their religious convictions would influence the major decisions they have to make on policy issues, international relations, religious freedom, and the like. From the very first State of Belief radio broadcast, I have asked guests how political leaders should talk about religion to ensure respect for religious diversity, convey personal convictions, and assure that a public office will not be used to advance a singular religious tradition or even the importance of religion over non-religion. Frankly, finding good models for speaking about personal faith in the political arena has not been easy. But President Obama offered just such a model this past week during a backyard visit with a group of people in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, what's most interesting about this incident is that the questioner framed her inquiry perfectly, and the president responded with integrity, sensitivity, and a commitment to religious liberty. I want us to listen together to what happened. Speaking to the president, a woman told him that she had three questions for him, but the first one is the focus of our attention.
Mother Teresa answered it in an article, and I was going to ask you the same because I loved her answer. The first one is, why are you a Christian?
Let me tell you why that is a good question. It's not an attack, rather, it's a fair assumption. The president has spoken frequently of his Christian faith, so there's no criticism implied here. Just an honest search for information, the kind of question any citizen has a right to ask. The president's response matched the wisdom in the question.
You know, I'm a Christian by choice. You know, my family didn't. Yeah, you know, frankly, they weren't folks who went to church every week. I mean, my mother was one of the most spiritual people I knew, but she didn't raise me in the church. So I came to my Christian faith later in life, and it was because the precepts of Jesus Christ spoke to me in terms of the kind of life that I would want to lead. Being my brother's and sister's keeper. Treating others as they would treat me. And I think also understanding that, you know, that Jesus Christ dying for my sins spoke to the humility we all have to have as human beings, that we're sinful and we're flawed and we make mistakes, and that, you know, we achieve salvation through the grace of God. But what we can do, as flawed as we are, is still see God in other people and do our best to help them find their you know, their own grace.
Do you hear what's happening? The president is being very personal, autobiographical, in a manner that doesn't exclude anyone. He limits his comments to his own beliefs, with no suggestion that anyone else has to share those beliefs in order to be a good religious person or a good American. Theology and autobiography merge in a spirit of openness and inclusion. And then quickly, the president moves from his personal beliefs to his responsibility for protecting the Constitution and respecting all people in this nation without regard to their religion.
And so that's what I strive to do. That's what I pray to do every day. I think my public service is part of that effort to express my Christian faith. And it's but the one thing I want to emphasize, having spoken about something that obviously relates to me very personally, as President of the United States, I'm also somebody who deeply believes that the part of the bedrock strength of this country is that it embraces people of many faiths and of no faith. That this is a country that is still predominantly Christian, but we have Jews, Muslims, Hindus, atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, and that their own path to grace is one that we have to revere and respect as much as our own. And that's part of what makes this country what it is.
Now notice, the president was not a Christian evangelist on the campaign trail trying to offer an appeal to Christianity. He identified himself as a man of faith. But in that setting, it was even more important that he identify himself as the leader of this nation, concerned about everybody. His advocacy was for the Constitution. Now, the president's handling of this sensitive issue is exemplary. He answered the woman's question honestly. He spoke of his personal faith openly. And he made sure that people understand his commitment to strengthening the Constitution. Let me humbly suggest that if more speakers on the campaign trail would demonstrate such a thoughtful response to the relationship between religion and politics, both religion and the nation would be better for it. Finally, this past week, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life released the results of a survey testing the knowledge of Americans about the organized religions that play a significant role in our society. Let me tease you for a moment. You would never guess the poll's findings on the people who know most about Christianity. I'll give you a hint. They're not Christians. Those most knowledgeable about Christianity were atheists, Jews, and Mormons. No wonder the surprising results garnered extensive press coverage. The average respondent was able to answer about half of the 32 questions about Scripture, religious figures, traditions, and teachings, and the place of religion in our society. Let me give you a few examples. Where was Jesus born? What is Ramadan? Whose writings inspired the Protestant Reformation? Which biblical figure led the Exodus from Egypt? What religion is the Dalai Lama? What religion is Joseph Smith, Mother Teresa? Of the thousands of Americans who were asked questions about the world's largest religions, self-identified atheists and agnostics achieved the highest scores. Close behind were people of Jewish and Mormon faiths. At a time when religious issues are being exploited so blatantly to promote and oppose political ideas, it's particularly disturbing that many of the folks responding to these calls may know little about their own faith traditions and even less about those of others. The questions that were answered correctly most often: are teachers allowed to lead prayers in public schools? 89% of all respondents got that one right. 85% correctly said atheists are people who don't believe in God. But only 16% knew that only Protestants, not Catholics, traditionally teach that salvation comes through faith alone. You can take a 15-question version of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life Religious Knowledge Quiz. Just find the link as well as additional information on the topics covered in this week's show at stateofbelief.com. It's a good time to visit us online, a pretty thorough visit, because that's all the time we've got for State of Belief Radio today. But if you like what you've heard, find out more about us there and then tell a friend. Announce it at the coffee shop. Help us get out the word about this show, State of Belief Radio. Tell people to visit us online and to sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of the Interfaith Alliance. If you want to get more involved in the cause of religious liberty, come on. Join us. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be back here on State of Belief Radio next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics, probably some surprises. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, that's when Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only